My name is David Schaff, and I'm an alcoholic. And let me tell you, there's a lot of y'all here tonight. Before I get started talking, let me say something. John, I want to say thank you to John Deloach, our delegate, who asked me, I guess late January, early February, if I'd be willing to do this, and I told him I would. John's one of those people for me that has helped bring me up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've known him pretty much for my entire sobriety except for the first 9 months I was sober. And I've watched him go through the years and followed in his footsteps and a lot of other people's footsteps. So, John, thank you for showing the courage and the faith and letting me stand up here and represent you as well as everybody in District 5. You know, normally when you stand before a group of your peers that are going to judge you to some degree, they put the jury is off to the side. But I'm going to tell you, tonight the jury is on the first 2.5 rows. They have made scorecards. I have one fan, Pembroke Tom, made a We Love Dave sign. So Tom, thank you very much for that. Delia's got a smiley face. Dan, what did I say, Pembroke Dave? Tom, whatever. I don't know how many people. I had a bunch of people ask me, are you nervous? And I'm so nervous, it's unbelievable. At 3 o'clock, Liz Pack asked me going into the DCM meeting, are you nervous? And I said, no. And at 3:10, Delia leaned over to me in the DCM meeting and said, are you nervous? And I said, yes. So, and that's how it's been. I would like to introduce one person who has meant a lot to me, and you'll get to hear about her as I move along in my talk. And that is my wife, Lucille Schaffner. She's 15 years sober. Lucille, please stand. And I can tell you honestly that if it were not for her, you would have a different speaker here tonight. For that, Lucille, I love you. Thank you for being with me. All right. I think I got all that out of the way. I did tell you my name was David. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Savannah group. We meet every Monday and Thursday in Savannah at the 24-hour club. We have an open speaker meeting on Monday and an open discussion meeting on Thursday. And if you're ever in town on any of those days, please come visit us. We would love to have you. Especially if you're there on a Monday, see me or any group member. Let us know you're there because you're probably speaking that night. My sobriety date is January 27th, 1987. Now, I have just covered all the instructions my wife gave me to make sure I followed. After that, she told me I was on my own. So here goes nothing and everything all at one time. I was born and raised in Savannah. I'm a native Georgian. I grew up not a typical typical for us, you know. What I've discovered, almost all of us come from a family that might very well be the poster child for the anti-Leave It to Beaver campaign. And I certainly came from that. I didn't realize that till I got here and got sober for a while. Then I realized just how different it was. But I survived it, and that's certainly not the reason I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I drink way, way too much Budweiser. That's what did it for me. I took my first drink, I think, and I'm not one of those who knows exactly when they took their first drink. I think I took it somewhere between the age of 11 and 13. My mother was on what back then was called a high iron diet. The doctor suggested she have a small glass of wine and eat a lot of red meats. And there were five of us kids, and she would routinely, after her third or fourth small glass of wine, ask one of us to get her the next one. And I did that one night, and poured way too much in it, completely accidental. Sipped off the excess, and after that, I poured way too much in it every time she asked me to get her one. But like I said, I don't know exactly what age that was. I think somewhere between 11 and 13, and that's the best I could do to narrow it down. I am standing before you. There are those out there tonight. As I've gotten older, I'm 41. When I was 17 years old and in the Air Force, I had a woman at a beer bar at 17 guess me to be 32 years old. And I always qualify that by saying she was, you know, drunk. But I have always looked older than what I am. So that was a benefit when I was younger, because at the age of 15, I figured out, and my friends figured out, that I could go into a liquor store in Savannah, a little place we call Fat Man's Liquor Store, because there was a fat man that owned it. And we were pretty simple. But I could go into a liquor store and I could buy, and he never bothered me. You know, and I wasn't buying the, you know, we were drinking pink champagne, you know, the good stuff. It came in, and it didn't come in six packs, it came in four packs, and I'd go in and buy 2 4-packs for the four of us, and, you know, you would think, okay, 4 guys, 8 drinks, that's 2 apiece, but I'm the crowning joy out of that foursome, and none of them are alcoholic, and I usually got 4 or 5 out of the 8. Of course, I would qualify that by saying, well, I had to go buy it, but I was off and running at that early age and didn't have a clue that's what was going on. At 17 years old, by the time I was 17 years old, I had lots and lots of problems at home. Like so many other people I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not care for authority figures. I could not stand for someone to tell me what it was I had to do, where it was I needed to be, and when I had to be there. I completely rebelled against anything like that. I also grew up with the crushing burden of potential. I routinely had teachers say, he's so smart, but, you know, he's just not doing. And I was watching a movie with Lucille the other day, and some character on the movie, the statement was made about the kid that you could do so well if you would just, you could exceed ahead of your peers if you would just apply yourself. And I told her, I said, I don't know how many times I was told that growing up. But no one ever took the time to explain to me, why should I want to exceed? It's so much simpler just to go the other way. What is the benefit of exceeding? Why would I want to apply myself and study when I'd much rather go outside and play hoops with the guys? So I never, ever applied myself at all when it came to school. Beyond the 6th grade, I applied myself in some of the anti-school functions, but never applied beyond that. But anyway, I grew up, like I said, completely rebelling against everything. So at the age of 16, we had one of those big family gatherings, and a little blowout. And at the age of 16, I walked out of my family's home because I didn't want to deal with what was going on. And I just moved out. I was gone at the summer of my 16th year. And moved in with a preacher and his family and had a job and was paying my own way. But couldn't make it. I didn't have the skills to manage that, to pull that off. I did have a traffic accident during that time where I was drinking, but I was not cited for the accident. So I still, it was a slow pattern beginning then that I was not able to see. So at that point, I went back home with the agreement with my mother that I would do anything she said for me to do when she told me to do it. And I would go back to school and attend school on a daily basis, which, you know, I was enrolled, but I was rarely there. But so I said, okay, fine. And it took me about 2 weeks to figure out this is not going to work. I can't do this. There's no way. And instead of doing, I had actually matured some during the time I was gone. So instead of simply rebelling, I went to her and told her I can't do it. You know, I just can't do this. There's no way. So to get away from the problems with the authority figures in my life, I put my brilliant brain together and I joined the military to get away from authority figures. I ought to tell you how bright I am. And let me tell you, my parents could not sign that paperwork fast enough to let me go. So at 17 years old, I took the GED, passed it. That was in I turned 17 in February 7th. Took the GED, went down and did all the other stuff. And to make a long story short, May 15th of that year, I went into the United States Air Force. ready for the world. Now, I had a plan. My plan at that time, I was going to go in the Air Force, and I bowled. I grew up in bowling alleys, and I was fairly good at it. My plan was to go in the Air Force for 4 years, bowl all I could, get out, and turn pro. And, you know, that's my whole plan. Should have worked fine, you know. But I discovered booze and fell in love with it, and that was all she wrote. Bowlers are routinely referred to as kegglers, and there's a good reason for that. We drank by the keg, at least I did, many, many times. But that whole plan didn't work out too well. At the age of 19, I fell in sick with Lucille. It was a great get-together. It really was. The rocks in her head fit the holes in my head. You know, I built castles in the sky, and she'd move in. And wonderful, wonderful. You know, our friends used to tell us, you deserve each other. So anyway, we locked horns. I was 19, and she didn't know I was 19. Again, I looked older, and she was 30 and married. Didn't bother me. You know, I didn't come here with morals. You had to teach them to me. So anyway, we fell in sick. But she figured out how old I was. One day she says, I was stationed at Beale Air Force Base in California, and she says, let's go downtown. Let's go bar hopping. I said, can't. She said, really? You restricted to the base? I said, no. You got to work? No. Well, let's go bar hopping. I'm not old enough. She said, what do you mean? I've seen you drink. I said, yeah, on base I can drink. It's 18. Downtown is 21. She said, how old are you? I told her, and she just about fell out the car. She was accused by more than one person of robbing the cradle. And I really like that. So anyway, we started our little dance of death, so to speak, and got on our merry way. And just so that you know, she's definitely alcoholic, and after this I'll try to put her out as hard, you know, because we've been married. We've been married 21 years last month. So. And that applause, I know, is for her, having put up with this all that time. So anyway, we started our little deal, and we went through all kinds of things to stop David from drinking, because she didn't drink at that time as much as I did, and we certainly didn't think she had a problem. We figured that out after I got sober and she started coming to meetings with me. But somewhere, just like I said, to prove to you she's alcoholic, she got divorced on Friday. We married on Saturday. And if you ever get the chance to hear her talk, she'll tell you it was because she knew she could fix me. She figured out I was young, she could train me right. And just didn't work out that way. It's not been too bad with y'all's help, though, so we're still together. Thank God for the steps and the traditions. That's really what's got us through. So anyway, we started little recipes to try and stop David's drinking, because she knew if I'd quit drinking, everything would be wonderful. Didn't work out that way. I crossed the line, I believe, into alcoholism somewhere between January and March of 1980. I was on a permissive TDY from Beale Air Force Base in California to Plattsburgh Air Force Base in New York. I was there 58 days. I was drunk 57. The one day I was sober, my newfound flight chief called me into his office and told me, I don't know where you went last night. I don't know what you did, but I want you to turn your weapon in and go home. I was a security policeman. He said, turn your weapon in and go home and don't come back in this condition again. So I didn't. I stayed drunk the rest of the time I was there. He had never seen me sober. He had known me at that time for about 30 days, and he had never seen me sober, and I scared him when I showed up, able to stand guard mount without rocking back and forth, and I was actually talking to other guys on flight, and he just knew it was strange behavior for this kid from California. But that's the point I crossed the line, I believe, in alcoholism. And I was 17 and 18 years old, 1980. I swore off of alcohol the first time that I remember coming home from that trip. I told the guy I was rooming with, I said, I'm swearing off, got to do it. Can't drink no more, this stuff's killing me. I got to take a break. I'm going on the milk wagon, I told him. We flew from Plattsburgh back to California, and I went and had lunch at the bowling alley, which was normal for me, and had milk with lunch on the milk wagon. And that night, someone asked me to bowl, and I ordered two Budweisers, and I was off the milk wagon that same night. So my first swearing off lasted about, 10 hours maybe, if I was lucky. But that's how it would go. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not trying to come see you. It was not my goal. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous like so many other people. I was running from other problems. I had a bunch of crap going on in my life. I was stationed in San Antonio, Texas. I was working at the Security Police Academy as an instructor. Everything on the outside, much like I've been told tonight, looked real good. But on the inside, I was dying. Now, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to turn to. I didn't know what the problem was. I knew what some of the problems were, but I didn't know what to do about them. And I was scared to death to tell anybody what was going on inside of David. Suicide at this point had become a regular comfort, the idea of just checking out. And I thought about it for probably the last full year I was drinking. It was a regular thought. My problem with that was we didn't keep any weapons in the house because I had two kids at home. When I was drunk, no one was about to give me a .38. That's when I had the courage. I guarantee you, if I'd had a weapon at home on any given night, after about 18 or 19 beers, I could have pulled the trigger. I don't doubt that beyond any doubt. It's in me. But I never had a weapon drunk, and when I sobered up, I didn't have the courage to do it, and I didn't think about it. And I carried a .38 at the academy. I carried a .38 probably 9 out of 10 days during training. I had a weapon on me readily available, but stone cold sober, I couldn't do it. I just could not do it sober. But drunk, I could have. So that's one of those little things God did for me that I was not able to do for myself. The day that I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, Lucille had been working. She came home. I told her a few things that scared the bejesus out of her. She didn't know what to do with that information. To make a long story short, I wound up in my commander's office the next morning and told him, just to get the heat off, I think I got a drinking problem. I didn't believe it. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. But I knew what the military would do with that information. He would get me some kind of help. So that's what I told him. So we talked for a few minutes, and that was on a Tuesday. And he invited me to go with him to see a drug and alcohol counselor. I didn't know that's what it was. He said, let's go to Social Actions. And so we did. And I met a guy there named Jerry Pinson, who was 18 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was very active at that time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jerry sat and talked to me, and he told me his story. And I thought, man, he's in bad shape. You know? Whew, buddy, you need some help. But he invited me to an AA meeting that Thursday night, right there in the same building we were sitting in. And he asked me if I'd like to come, and I said, fine. And because I knew the way the military works, you get invited to something like that, you go, you know, because if you don't accept the invitation, they're going to make you go anyway. So I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So he told us about Al-Anon, and we showed up, Lucille and I together, arm in arm, locked, at my first AAA meeting, her first Al-Anon meeting. And we arrived there at the Social Actions building, and the AAA meeting went off to the right. And it had a common door jam with the next door, which went to the left, which was the Al-Anon meeting. And we stood there locked arm in arm facing the door jam, trying to figure out which way we were going. And she didn't want to let go. I didn't want to let go. And finally she looked at me and she says, you want me to go with you? And I said, oh, absolutely, let's go. And off we went into the AA meeting. That first meeting was a birthday meeting. It was a dual speaker meeting. That night I heard a guy named John C., who was a carpenter, and I heard a lady who was a housewife tell their story. And I've never been a carpenter, and I've never been a housewife, but I understood both of them. I got my first connection in this program at my very first AA meeting. I understood what they were saying. In that very first meeting in San Antonio, the meeting that particular, most of the meetings here in Georgia, we read how it works from the podium. All the meetings I go to, and we do that here at the assembly. But there, they don't do that. Down there, they pass how it works down on one side, and they pass the traditions down on the other side of the room. And I was sitting on the side of the room that night where they were doing how it works. And like I told you before, I was really smart when I got here. And I watched how it works move around the room, and I figured out after about the second or third person, the way this works is you tell them your name, you tell them you're an alcoholic, and then you read a paragraph or three things. So I figured that out, and I thought, well, they're not going to pass that to me. They don't know me. They've never seen me. I'm not an alcoholic. But I watched that paper move around and finally got to the guy next to me, and he read, and he handed it to me. And I told him my name was David, and I was an alcoholic, and I cried like a baby while I read step 7, 8, and 9. And I know there were old-timers in that room that night, and they said, look at that. Isn't that wonderful? Look at the spiritual release he's getting. Telling us he's finally accepted he's an alcoholic. God, it's wonderful. And like I told you, I wasn't crying. I didn't get no spiritual release. I was mad. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, and I only said it because you made me say it. I was afraid you might make me leave. And Jared already told me I had to stay for the whole meeting. So that was my first AA meeting. After that meeting was over, this guy who came up to me, I don't remember his name, he was 90 days sober. And I remember thinking, 90 days? You did that on purpose? That's like 3 months. But he said, and he talked to me about getting honest. He said, it's not going to work if we don't get honest. I didn't even know what it was at that point. But I came away from that meeting, I don't know what it was, but like I said, I made a connection while I was there. I understood inside to some degree what was going on. And as a result of talking to that fellow about being honest, I called my commander up at 1 o'clock in the morning that night. And because like I said, I got here running from other problems. I did not believe I was an alcoholic. And I had some things that were really tearing me up on the inside. So I called him up 1 o'clock in the morning. I said, look, would you meet me in your office and bring your wife, because I'm bringing mine. And to make a long story short, I told him I did a mini fifth step without knowing that's what I was doing. Now, I don't recommend that to anybody, you know, especially if you're in the military. Because the end result of that is they launched an investigation, which consequently got me a general discharge 9 months later. Which was fine. Again, that was one of those things God did for me that I was not capable of doing for myself, because I would have stayed there, period, in fear, likely in fear the entire time. But I got a release that night after that first meeting and doing that mini fifth step with that commander for the first time that I could remember in I don't know how long. I got here 10 days short of my 25th birthday. And I had such a release. That's when I got my spiritual release. I was free. I walked out of his office that morning, not in handcuffs, thank God, but floating. And I knew whatever was God had in store for me would be good. I could get by, you know, because I can face this and get through it. Now, I didn't know I was going to face it with you. I had no idea you were going to help me through all the things I was going to have to face. I had no idea. If I'd known then what you were going to teach me over the course of the next 16 years, I would not have stayed. Bottom line, I wouldn't have been able to handle it. I never would have been able to handle it at that point. So off and running we were. I started going to AA meetings. and loved it, loved every minute of it. Lucille started going to Al-Anon. I remember one of the first AA meetings we went to, Sheila started learning that Al-Anon lingo, and some lady, when the AA meeting was over, walked over and said, "Have you met my alcoholic?" And Lucy said no, and the lady introduced this guy, and Lucy piped up and she says, "Well, have you met my alcoholic?" And we were getting all the lingo down fast, baby. But again, you know, and I got all this fast. I got it quick. I remember sitting in, coming home from our, I went to my first meeting on a Thursday and went to my second meeting on a Friday. And on the way home that night from the meeting, I remember driving and thinking, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. They're probably not using their real names. I have always liked the name Paul. Think I'll be Paul and an alcoholic. That'll be good. Fortunately, I never did that. They have always known me everywhere I've gone as David. But that, again, is to give you an idea how brilliant I was. I remember we came out of that meeting that night before we headed home, and somebody invited us. They said, "You want to go to the 10:30 meeting?" And we had just come out of an 8:15 to 9:15 meeting, and I said, "No." Yeah. "Not really." And I got in the car, and I remember our conversation was, "Man, they do this all day and all night. Ain't they got lives or nothing?" But that meeting I turned down going to eventually became my very first home group. But I remember that was on Friday night. On Saturday, by this point, we had a schedule. Someone suggested I go to the 11:30 noon meeting. That's no more alcoholic jingo. What time's a noon meeting start? 11:30. We figure it out, don't we? So they invited us. They said, "You know, go to the noon meeting." And we got there, and I met a guy named Mike Schoolcraft while I was there. And he asked me, he says, "Do you have a big book?" And I said, "What's that?" And he explained to me what the big book was, and he got me one, and I didn't think it was that big. I wasn't particularly impressed by it. I'd seen bigger books. But he also asked me if I had a sponsor, and I said, "What's that?" And so he got me the pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. And he said, "Go home and read that, and that'll answer all your questions." I said, "Okay, fine." So I went home and I read the pamphlet. Now, I've read that pamphlet since then. What I got out of that pamphlet was, I got the power. If I want William to sponsor me, I ask William, "Will you sponsor me?" He's going to say yes, if he wants to stay sober. If he says no, it's because he don't want to stay sober, and I don't need a sponsor like that anyway. So I showed up on Sunday morning for the men's meeting, armed with this knowledge, and immediately searched the room. And I got there probably 20 minutes before the meeting started. The military taught me to be early everywhere I go. So I got there 20 minutes before, and all those who were there when I got there, I went around the room and I figured out why they didn't qualify as my sponsor. You know, either they were too tall or too short, or they had on a funny shirt, or they didn't have all their teeth, or they weren't drinking coffee, they were drinking soda, or, you know, any number of reasons. I just went through the whole room and figured out why each one just wasn't perfect enough, you know. So the meeting began, and the guy, Mike Schoolcraft, was chairing the meeting, and he brought up the topic, sponsorship. Funny how we do that to newcomers. And topic went around the room, and eventually he called on me, knowing what our conversation had been the previous day. And the shortest I'd ever talked in Alcoholics Anonymous was that day. He called on me, and I told him my name was David, and I was an alcoholic. "I don't have a sponsor. I'm looking for a sponsor. Thank you very much." And I shut up. Meeting got over, and some guy, can't remember his name, but he came over. He was from Houston. He came over and he stuck his hand out and he introduced himself. "I'm so-and-so from Houston." He said, "This is Doug." He said, "I'm Doug's sponsor. Doug just moved here from Houston. I just helped him move in." He said, "Doug is 9 months sober. I took Doug through the steps in a week, and Doug can do the same for you. You need a sponsor. He needs to be a sponsor. Y'all get together." And he walked off. I read the pamphlet. It don't work that way. I don't know Doug. I've never seen Doug. I don't want Doug to be my sponsor. But Doug is about 6'4", 240 pounds. I'm not telling Doug no. Doug became my first sponsor. And it was excellent, because had this guy not done that for me, with God's guidance, I'm sure, I might not have ever had a sponsor, because you would have never, ever measured up. Never. I would have sponsored myself. Yeah. You laugh in identification, I believe. So anyway, Doug, off and running we went, and Doug set me off on the steps. You know, I heard that challenge from his sponsor. I took Doug through the steps in 7 days. You know, I love a good challenge. About 7 days, I've read those steps. We can do that in less than seven. I'm going to beat this record. So Doug gave me some information on how to do the steps, and then we went through one, two, and three fast. Nothing to it, you know, no problem. Went beyond that first week, and I knew I couldn't beat the record, so I slowed down just a little bit. You know, I wasn't going to beat his record, so I was okay. But he gave me instructions on how to do a four-step, and I actually did it as good as I could, less than 30 days sober. I know now it was slightly fearful and not too courageous, but I did a four-step, and it had some of those horrendous things that I had actually shared with my commander and a couple of other small mine. I didn't, you know, I couldn't just stop with one or two. I had to fill it up a little bit. But anyway, I went to Doug. I was about 2.5 weeks sober, I think, and I said, "I got my fourth step done. I'm ready for my fifth." He said, "Okay, fine." And we made an appointment, and I met him the next morning at a Jim's restaurant, which is the equivalent to a Denny's, at lunchtime to do my fifth step. It's busy. And I'm sitting across from Doug, and I'm whispering, "And then..." And he's talking all loud so the whole restaurant can hear what the heck's going on. But we got through that, me trying to whisper my fifth step to him, and he gave me instructions. And to sum this up, I went through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I was 30 days sober, I was done. Finished. The good thing about that was I was had been invited by the military to go to treatment. And I accepted that invitation as well. And at 30 days sober, I entered treatment. And I knew at that point I had a higher power, I had a God consciousness far beyond my 30 days of sobriety. And I knew the reason I was going to treatment was so I could help some of those folks. Because they didn't know much about AA, and I'd already done the steps. I understood full well while I was there. So they immediately put me on the nut ward for detox. And they didn't want to hear that stuff about I'm 30 days sober. It was just standard practice. And that was, you know, I figured out 3 days on the nut ward, they're my kind of people. I had a blast. I'll warn you, if you ever wind up in that situation, we played cards, and I grew up, like I said, local, and we played cards growing up, and we played spades, and we'd get real loud and slam cards and all kinds. We'd talk a lot of junk, and that's how we were playing in the nut ward, and we were playing with a schizophrenic. She was happy when she was winning. It's not a good thing when they start losing. It got ugly fast. So that ended that particular game. We snaked away. But 3 days on the nut war, I got my first resentment because I got there on my 30th day of sobriety. I wanted to get my 30-day chip, you know, so that they knew how special I was, and they wouldn't let me off the nut ward. 3 days later, they finally put me on the AA ward, and I went through treatment and got a great education. If you've gone through or thinking about it or whatever the case may be, I got a lot out of treatment. It taught me a lot about the disease and how it works and how it affects me and all those good things. I learned about recovery with you. That's where it came from for me. I liked treatment. It got me away for what I needed at that time. Did me a lot of good. But I recovered here with you. So anyway, I came out of treatment 60 days sober. And off and running. I started hanging out, and I didn't know it at the time, but I started hanging out. They told me, stick with the winners. You know, we say don't judge each other, and I thought, well, that doesn't make sense. How do I figure out who the winners are if I don't judge what you're doing? You confuse me. Not the first time and not the last. So I said, okay, fine, I'll figure this out. I started sticking with the people. I showed up at meetings, and they were laughing. That's what attracted me to you, the laughter. I laughed in my very first AA meeting along with crying, and that's what made me want to come back. So those people who were laughing before, during, and after the meetings, those are the ones I started hanging out with. It just so happened, and it didn't mean anything to me at the time, but they were secretaries, treasurers, GSRs, intergroup reps, DCMs, and I didn't have a clue. But just hanging out with them and hearing their conversations and their discussions on service work, I wanted a job. You know? I want what you got. You know, I understood that. You want what I got, you do what I did. I said, okay, fine. I want what you got. I want to be able to come to a meeting and laugh. Now, I want a job. I was 2 months sober. You know, they weren't giving me a lot of jobs. They weren't electing me to GSR, not yet. So about 4 months sober, they put the word out. They needed a district secretary. And you needed to be able to breathe in and out and write. I qualified. So I became the district secretary. And I did that for the rest of the time I was in San Antonio, which was up until I was 9 months sober. At 9 months sober, actually just 2 or 3 days short of 9 months sober, the investigation on me that they had done as a result of talking to my commander was finished, and they decided, okay, we've had enough of you. Sign here and go home. And I said, okay, fine. And I was 1 day short of 9 months sober. And we closed it overnight with a friend of ours named Carol. That morning we got up, hung around that day. That night I went to my regular group meeting that Tuesday night, the Marbach meeting. I picked up my 9 month medallion and I came home to Savannah. I stopped over in Camilla for 2 weeks and met Ennis and a bunch of other folks. And that's when I began to realize just how important I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I got there and they asked me to speak. Big out of town speaker, boy, I felt good. I don't know how their opinion about it was, but hopefully they forgot most of that. I don't know. But anyway, I got to Savannah, and I knew immediately why God sent me to Savannah. He'd sent me to Savannah to teach them how to run AA meetings because they were doing it wrong. They weren't doing it the way we did it in San Antonio at all. And I remember writing a letter back to a guy named Jim and telling that to him, you know, they're doing it wrong and they won't listen to me. And he wrote me back and said, do it their way. And I said, okay, fine. I ain't writing him no more. So I started doing it their way, and I joined a little group called the 12-step group, and they made me, shortly thereafter, they celebrated my first year in January. I arrived in Savannah in early November, celebrated my first year in January, and they elected me as intergroup rep and continued with the service work. That May, I came to my very first ever assembly in May of 1988. I sat right here on the front row. I didn't want to miss nothing. Actually, they told me when I got here, I said, where should I sit? And the guy said, sit up front. You don't need to miss nothing. So I did, and I've been doing that ever since. But I sat right here on the front row that morning, and I listened to my very first state delegate, Ms. Gay Garner, give her first report for my ears. And in the business meeting that morning, in her report, she made me laugh and she made me cry. And she made me want what we have here. And I will ever, forever be indebted to her for giving me that enthusiasm from the beginning. Thank you so much for that. But that got me fired up for Alcoholics Anonymous. First assembly I ever went to, and I had it, baby. I wanted what you had. People up here were full of energy and laughing and fighting it out in meetings and just, it was it. It was it. I had arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous as far as I was concerned. I wanted to do this. Shortly during that time or around that time, I'll share this. I told you before I got here I was suicidal. I celebrated my first year and I quickly, things weren't going the way I thought they would. I thought at a year sober there were probably six or eight guys at least sitting out there waiting on me to get my 1 year chip so I could sponsor them. And nobody came up and asked me to sponsor them. And that started a downward spiral for me in terms of what I thought I had and what I thought you had enabled me to get through the steps and the traditions. But around 15, 16 months sober, go into meetings, had a home group, had a sponsor that I wasn't talking to. But I became suicidal in sobriety. And let me tell you, that sucks. That's the worst. I had three options. Drink, which had long since not been an option. Work the steps, or commit suicide. And committing suicide was a viable option. But instead of doing that, I heard a guy named Charlie speak, and he talked about being suicidal in sobriety, and I thought, okay, I can talk to him. Eventually, he became my sponsor, and I was able to go back through the steps and work through that and learn again to smile sincerely in an AA meeting, because I'd gotten to the point where I could fake it. You know, I could hit the steps of the clubhouse in Savannah and somebody'd say, "How's it going, David?" "Oh, it's great. Man, if it got any better, I'd have to hire somebody to smile for me." I could do that. But I worked through that and managed to stay sober and not hurt me or anybody else around me. As a result of that, I can tell you today I have a sponsor. I have a home group. I have some guys that actually allow me to sponsor them. There, a lot of them are here tonight, sitting with the jury. One of the toughest things I've done in sobriety, 2 years ago, July 4th will be 2 years ago, when I was about just short of 5 years sober, I had gone through a couple of sponsors, and I finally asked a guy named Mike Curran if he'd sponsor me. And he said he would. And we worked together for about 9 years. And we played golf together. We socialized together. He became the person I leaned on the most in this program. He was there constantly. I knew if I got in that 3 o'clock in the morning pain, when I'd gone through and punched a hole in every wall in the house till I finally hit a stud, I knew I could call Michael and say, "I got to talk, meet me for coffee," and he'd be there. And on July 4th, 2 years ago, he passed away. And I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. But I went out with his permission and picked a new sponsor, and I started that journey again. And almost 2 years into it, there's a certain trust I've been able to develop with Butch. And he's somebody that, the way I work this program, my sponsor has, I give my sponsor the privilege or the right to tell me just what it is he wants to tell me, and I don't hold it against him. And he does that. And I need someone that knows that I can live with that. You know, I will not fire him because I'm mad. I will figure out why I'm mad and go back to him, and we'll figure out how to work through that together. And it works very well for me. Without sponsorship, I would not be here today. Last thing I want to talk about is extremely important to me. And you told me that if I was going to get sober and stay sober and be happy about it, I had to discover a higher power. I was told, and my book tells me, that if I don't have one, I'm sunk. It does not matter how many meetings I go to. It does not matter how many service commitments I have. It does not matter how many guys I say I sponsor. It does not matter who sponsors me. If I do not have a higher power, I will not make it. You convinced me of that early. You know, they told me, try praying and do it on your knees. And I don't know how they knew, but my first reaction was, I ain't getting on my knees and praying. But they followed it up with, if you have a problem getting on your knees, put your shoes underneath the bed when you go to bed that night. And the next morning when you're on your knees getting your shoes, pray. And you can ask my wife, the very first time I did it, I put my boots underneath the bed. And that morning I said, God, please help me. And I got up. I didn't want her to see me on my knees talking to something that wasn't there. But you have allowed me, you have guided me, you have walked me through. Charlie Yao, one of the guys I sponsor, talks about heroes in this program. Gay Garner is a hero for me. Brookings Beck, Randy Sellers. All these people, John, Mike Curran, all these people in my life have guided me through this program to some sense of a quality life. They've done that for me without me asking, simply because it was given to them. And I try to give that back. But part of that is a connection with a higher power that I had to have in order to stay sober. And it's hard for me to explain it. But I found something years ago that describes or sums up what you have done for me. And I'll end with this. Says it was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it was scarcely worth his while to waste his time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bid, good people, he cried, who starts this bidding for me? $1, $1, do I hear two? $2, who makes it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three. But no, from the room far back, a gray-bearded man came forward and picked up the bow. After wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up the strings, played a melody pure and sweet, sweet as the angel sings. The music ceased. The auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, what now am I bid for this old violin? As he held it up with its bow. $1,000, $1,000, do I hear two? $2,000, who makes it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, going and gone, said he. The audience cheered, but someone inquired, we don't quite understand what changed its worth. Swift came the reply, the touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune is battered with bourbon and gin. It's auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like that old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game he travels on. Going once, going twice, he's going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of the soul, the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand. Bless you all.